Hello. On this week's program, we look at a show where anonymous personal confessions collected in drop boxes on the street are displayed at the Third Street Art Gallery in Old City, Philadelphia. Jason Piper visits the People's Light and Theatre in Malvern as they open Molière's last play, The Imaginary Invalid. And in our regular dip into the Culture Files section at gophila.com, we visit the Kimmel Centre for the Performing Arts. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
What if you could dump your secrets into a box on a street corner? Will that make them easier to bear? Is it still a secret if you write it down and hand it over, even anonymously? Everyone has their own answers to these questions, but now you can try it for yourself. Today is the last day to visit one of 10 confession boxes placed in Center City, Philadelphia, and drop off what's on your mind. There were 12 boxes originally, but one has been destroyed and another stolen, with a ransom note left behind. This is not the newest city service, but part of a public art project. Michael Seabright is one of the project's leaders. He says placeholdings began as a conversation about the people living in the city of Philadelphia and the built environment, the city itself, specifically the geographical area within William Penn's original grid.
Penn set up a grid very specifically to keep his city orderly and to allow humans to interact with one another and like make the scale manageable. But at the same time, it does a disservice to the humans because it separates them and keeps them from one another and organizes them when humans are just messy. We're messy people. And the confessions are really messy, because it's about who we are and what we've done wrong.
Hoping to start a dialogue with the people, they built confessional boxes, a little smaller than a postal service mailbox. The modest wooden constructions instruct the passerby to drop in a confession. The team has an appointed confessionger, whose job it is to go from locked box to locked box and gather the contents. The boxes have been on the street since July, and as Seabright says, the organizers really weren't sure what to expect, if anything.
We had no idea how it was going to go. We're like, we could be having a show in September and not have anything at all. But that's another kind of conversation then. And so we got a little frustrated the first 2 weeks. There was like not very many confessions, and they were okay. They weren't really sharing, and then we started getting a lot more. And I think it just took time for the people to be passing by every day and see it one day, but then not be coming back for like 2 more weeks. And they knew they wanted to do that, so they came back then through. Yeah, we were not sure how this was going to go.
The show opened this month on First Friday in Old City. Nodding to the group's initial thoughts of Philadelphia's gridded streets and the man-made structures that both separate and bring the people together, in the gallery they have constructed a wall partitioning the room. The newest confessions hang like airing laundry on a wire, waiting to be stamped with the date and location of their drop-off. On shelves are glass mason jars, each containing one confession, like specimens in a lab. Jessica McCollum is a designer and a member of the creative team. She says although the jars are meant to be opened, visitors often take a second before acting.
When people first come up to the shelves, they don't automatically go for a jar. They just kind of stand here and they'll look around and they'll actually look through the jars first. Like they're not sure if they should actually take one and open one up. But usually, especially if there's a few people around and they start to see people picking the jars up, they'll eventually pick one up.
It's unclear whether or not it's because people are not used to being able to touch objects in an art gallery or because of the secret nature of the jar's contents, but McCallum says having visitors open the jars and read the confessions is another way the group is hoping to encourage dialogue between Philadelphians, as she grabs a jar from the crowded shelf.
Open it, take it out, and so this is a confession that came from August 21st, 2006, and it says, "I regret all the stupid things I said to my father when I was young. Now he is dead, and I cannot take anything back."
The confessions range from the serious to the playful, as Michael Seabright explains.
Some of the confessions we've gotten have been very intimate. Some of them have been very brilliantly disclosed to us. I guess the one that sticks in mind is the two that are most interesting. We got one that was on a leaf. It said, "I've fallen before my time." And it was so poetic and really, really a beautiful moment in the project. Another one we got was, "I broke a piano," and it was on a piano hammer.
One person dropped off a different confession in each of the 12 boxes. On small pieces of yellow paper are short but powerful reflections on lost love and regretted actions.
This one says, "I didn't realize how much she meant to me until she left." And then this one says, "I thought it was going to just be me for a long time."
"The first girl I kissed might have liked me too, but she moved away."
"I really don't want to say it out loud, but..."
At 11 tonight, the boxes will be collected and the final installment of the project will begin. As of earlier this week, the Place Holdings crew were not sure exactly what the finished show would look like, but their hope was that it would be about creating dialogue. In celebration of the boxes coming home, there'll be a party at the Third Street Gallery tonight, and who knows if there's enough wine, maybe there'll even be some face-to-face confessions. Place Holdings is at the Third Street Gallery in Old City, Philadelphia through October 1st. In 2004, the People's Light and Theatre in Malvern staged The Miser, a comedy by the 17th century French playwright Molière. The show was a highlight of the theatre season and was particularly popular with high school audiences. Now People's Light is staging another Molière play, The Imaginary Invalid. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, this contemporary take on the classic work commemorates a master of comedy.
Molière is sometimes called France's Shakespeare. It's probably a fair comparison. In a span of 28 years, the French writer wrote over 30 major works, many of which are still performed today, some 300 years later. Known for his comedies, Molière was influenced by an Italian brand of theater called Commedia dell'arte. The improvisational dramatic form, which took root in the 16th century, is often performed with masks and is marked by satirical, slapstick, and lowbrow humor. According to the People's Light production director Lillian Groeg, Molière's propensity for this kind of comedy is much in evidence in The Imaginary Invalid.
It's a clown show. It's sort of like I Love Lucy or Laurel and Hardy, the Marx Brothers, which are basically clown shows.
Calling him a genius, Groeg says that Molière is one of those playwrights that truly does deserve descriptions that are perhaps thrown around too freely for others. She also says his plays are truly edgy and gritty. One reason his work has survived so many years.
The interesting thing about Molière is that there's always something very serious underneath all the clowning. And that's what makes him, as they say today, and I always use that with in tremendous quotation marks, edgy and gritty.
The Imaginary Invalid is the first Molière play that Groeg has directed, but she's performed his work before and notes his comedies are especially demanding of actors. Stephen Novelli, who's in the People's Light production and has worked in other Molière shows, agrees.
It's demanding in a way that much drama is not. The precision, the timing, the dialogue is back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You don't have time to forget a word. You just don't have the time. It's got to go that way or the gag's not going to work. Whatever that back and forth is leading up to, the physical comedy is the same way. Any slaps have to be timed, and they have to work the same way every time. So there's a lot of repetition of that kind of stuff in order to make that work.
In The Imaginary Invalid, Stephen Novelli plays the main character Argon, a severe hypochondriac who obsessively follows the faulty instructions of his doctor. The story is set in the 17th century, a time when medical experts frequently prescribed purgings, enemas, and bloodletting, usually more harmful than helpful. Witnessing the fatal results of such treatments, many people of the day were skeptical of doctors. In The Imaginary Invalid, Beraldi, played here by Peter Delorier, shares this skepticism. He tries to reason with Argon, who's convinced he will die because, for once, he didn't follow the doctor's orders.
"You've killed me, brother. What's wrong? I'm fluxing. I'm fluxing."
"Oh, good God, you're insane. I hope nobody sees you like this. Get hold of yourself. I beg you.
Now my organs are melting. Help me. Help me."
"Don't let your imagination run away with you. Hold fast to your intellect."
The Imaginary Invalid was originally written in French, so performances in English rely on the work of translators. People's Light and Theater is using a translation by the Baltimore-based James Magruder. Magruder was commissioned to do this interpretation of the play by the Yale Repertory Theater in Connecticut in 1999.
The classics need new translations every generation or so. Some writers like Chekhov need them every 25 years, others like Molière maybe 30, 40 years.
Magruder says the French language of the 1600s, when The Imaginary Invalid was written, is not drastically different from contemporary French, especially in contrast to the English language, which has changed greatly. He explains that the primary challenge of his translation work doesn't revolve so much around understanding the French text from over 330 years ago. He speaks and reads the language. Rather, the main task is to know how to best convey the work's tone and humor in English.
The English language has twice the vocabulary of French. Half of English is Latinate, like French, and half of it is Germanic. So there's just a whole, you know, the English and the American lexicon are just enormous in comic situations.
With an abundance of scatological humor, Magruder notes his version of The Imaginary Invalid was probably more influenced by the bawdy, animated Comedy Central television show South Park than by the more traditional British translations of 100 years ago. Director Lillian Groeg also believes the piece has a very modern quality.
He brings it to America. It's an American contemporary sound, so that an audience, particularly a very young audience, would contact immediately without any barrier of any kind.
The first audiences of the original Imaginary Invalid likely didn't have problems connecting with the relevance of the play either. Thought to have suffered from tuberculosis, Molière was in poor health when he wrote this comedy about a hypochondriac that doctors couldn't help. In addition to writing The Imaginary Invalid, Molière also directed and performed in the farce, playing the lead role of Argonne. During only the fourth performance of the play, he collapsed on stage and died just a few hours later. The Imaginary Invalid was the last play Molière wrote.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. The Imaginary Invalid is at the People's Lytton Theatre in Malvern through October 22nd. The Kimmel Centre for the Performing Arts will celebrate its fifth birthday in December. The centre has, since 2001, presented hundreds of acts in its four performing spaces and at the Academy of Music. It's also home to eight resident companies, the Philadelphia Orchestra, Pennsylvania Ballet, Peter Nero and the Philly Pops, the Opera Company of Philadelphia, Philadanco, the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, and the American Theatre Arts for Youth. Now, in our latest look inside the Culture Files cabinet at gophila.com, we take a tour of the Kimmel with some of the people who work there.
Hi, I'm Mervon Mehta, Vice President of Programming and Education at the Kimmel Center in Philly. Any music of any genre that's of quality, we believe, belongs on our stage. So whether it's a classical orchestra visiting from Berlin or Vienna or New York, or whether it's a Yo-Yo Ma or an Itzhak Perlman, or a jazz artist, Oscar Peterson, Dave Brubeck, Sonny Rollins, or a hip-hop artist like The Roots, a dance company like Philadanco, the greatest mime in the world, Marcel Marceau, they all belong at what we think is the best stage in the city. And so we try to bring the best of the best to the best building in the city and hopefully attract a great audience of very different audiences for different shows for everything. And so far that's worked pretty well for us. Overall, we do about 70 to 80 concerts every year. I would dare to say that most people, when you talk about the Kimmel Center, say, oh, that's home of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And we love having the Philadelphia Orchestra here. They're you know, one of the, if not the greatest orchestras in the world. And they do 120 concerts here a year. But we do over 700 concerts, 700 nights of music and theater and dance a year. And we try to do as diverse an offering as we possibly can. High-level music, dance, entertainment for everybody. In addition to all of our programming, we have a new opportunity that was given to us this past May when we opened our Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ. It's a 6,900 pipe organ. It's one of the biggest concert hall organs in the country. It opened to great fanfare with orchestra concerts and recitals and silent films. We even had an event called Pay to Play where anybody could get up and for $25 play our organ for us. And we got all kinds of people from really accomplished local church organists and amateur organists to five-year-old kids who wanted to come play chopsticks. And it was a really fun event. And Philly's really becoming organ central. With the Wanamaker organ, there's three or four really wonderful church organs in the city. The Irvine Auditorium on the campus of Penn has a great organ, and now we think we have one of the best concert hall organs in the world. Press came from all over the country to hear our organ in May, and we didn't hear a dissenting word about it. Everyone, including the organists and the press and the public, gave it a, you know, a standing ovation. It's we paid $6 million for it, so it better be good. So the building was designed to be a multi-purpose venue for various performing artists and performing arts companies. Primary company was the Philadelphia Orchestra. They had been looking for a new home or to build a new home for many, many, many years, and the powers that be said that let's build a great concert hall for the Philadelphia Orchestra, but let's make it available to other genres of music, and let's build a recital hall at the same time. And by the way, we'll have a parking lot and a restaurant and a big plaza where we can have kind of community events going on. And so all of that was built. Here now, 5 years later, we have a great concert hall for the orchestra, which is also has variable acoustics that we can adjust mechanically, so we can have an amplified concert. So we can have the Roots on one night, fairly loud hip-hop band, and orchestra the next night, and we can adjust the acoustics so that both sound equally as good. I have not been in a supposedly classical music hall that sounds as good for amplified music anywhere in the world, and I've been to a lot of them. We then have a 600-seat recital hall, which also can convert into a 550-seat dance and theater venue. So we can do Philadanko or Rainey Harris or Amadou and Miriam or Dara J, a Senegalese hip-hop band, but we can also do a solo piano recital in the same hall with a few hours of changeover to change the side of the stage.
Hello, my name is Tara Navarro, and I am one of the bartenders here at Cadence Restaurant over at the Kimmel Center. We do change the food sometimes here at the Kimmel Center. Sometimes if we have an occasional, we have like jazz concerts or world music concerts here, sometimes some Latin concerts, we might change a few things and, you know, switch it up and add some chef specials. It all really depends on what's going on here.
Benjamin Ferranda, and I am the assistant production manager. My favorite thing about the Kimmel building is all the moving parts. The stages in Perlman Theater and in Verizon Hall, there are lots of mechanical doohickeys that make the stage really malleable to different situations, and I think that's my favorite part.
I'm Velma Simmons, Director of Education at the Kimmel Center. And at the beginning of our program, we wanted to focus on American music. So many educational arts programs focus on the European aspect. We wanted to focus on what students don't know about their own culture. In this room where we're standing, these are costumes here that students can try on. And then standing over here, they can look at themselves in the mirror. So they can put on a conductor's tails and stand with the baton and conduct friends. Or they could go around and read about each resident company. The cello is significant because Verizon Hall is shaped like a cello, so that's why we have the cello there.
Inside the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts with the people who know it best. More information on this and a wealth of other great cultural destinations in the Philadelphia region is available at the Culture File section of gophilla.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Christine Barbush. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.